Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi roundly rejects direct talks with the U.S. on the 2015 deal, saying Iran sees no benefit in such negotiations. Russia says a new pipeline to China will replace the Nord Stream 2, adding gas exports to Europe will drop by about 50 billion cubic meters. Also, a new poll shows Brazil's presidential hopeful Lula da Silva has extended his lead over incumbent Jair Bolsonaro by 12 percentage points. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran's president has rejected direct talks with the United States to revive the 2015 deal, saying there is no benefit to such negotiations. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Ebrahim Raisi said the interests of the Iranian nation are not based on direct negotiations. He said it is now up to the U.S. to make a final decision on the revival of the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi also commented on new U.S. sanctions on the country. He said why the American side takes such measures if it wants an agreement. He emphasized that the sanctions removal must be accompanied by a guarantee in order to achieve a lasting agreement. Elsewhere in his remarks, Raisi stressed that the progress in the JCPOA revival talks also requires the resolution of the safeguards issues with the UN nuclear agency. Iran has repeatedly said that the deal is possible if the U.S. acts realistically. Iran's president says cooperation among countries targeted by U.S. sanctions will make them stronger.
The relationship between countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., such as Iran, Russia, or other countries, can overcome many problems and issues and make them stronger.
The Iranian president said Americans think by imposing sanctions against a country they can stop it, but they are wrong. Referring to the JCPOA revival talks, Raisi censured the Western states for proposing to hold negotiations while at the same time imposing new sanctions. He said they need to demonstrate goodwill for the revival of the 2015 deal. Raisi is in Uzbekistan to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Russian counterpart. He said Iran and Russia can offset the effects of U.S. sanctions by joining their forces. The two presidents underscored a joint resolve to enhance the strategic ties. And President Putin of Russia said relations with Iran are positively developing.
Relations between Russia and Iran are developing on all the vectors that have been formed in previous years. We are in the final stage of working on a new major treaty between Russia and Iran, which will mark the developing of relations at the level of a strategic partnership.
Putin said a delegation from Russia with representatives of 80 large companies will visit Iran next week. The Russian president welcomed Iran becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. On Wednesday, Iran signed an SCO memorandum of obligations and arrangements, getting one step closer to becoming the ninth member of the regional body. Iran's accession is expected to be finalized by April 2023. We have reached out to Eurasia and Caucasus Affairs expert Ahmad Qasimzadeh to discuss the importance of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He believes the SCO can be considered the NATO of the East.
Regarding the significance of Iran's membership in the SCO, it should be noted that the organization includes several countries such as China, India, with a high population, almost half world population, with major economic benefits for member states. I can also refer to security matters. The SCO summit can be considered as the NATO of the East, and that includes the economic, political, and security spheres. It can bring about the interests and benefits for member states.
The Russian energy minister says his country will sign a deal to construct a new pipeline to China to replace Nord Stream 2 gas link to Europe. Alexander Novak made the revelation during a visit to Uzbekistan to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. He said Moscow and Beijing would ink deals on the delivery of, quote, 50 billion cubic meters of gas per year. The future Force 2 pipeline in Siberia would fuel China's energy-hungry economy, partly via Mongolia. The Russian minister also said gas exports to the EU will drop by around 50 billion cubic meters this year. The new announcement comes amid Russia's energy row with Europe. The Nord Stream 2 was designed to double the flow of Russian gas to Germany through the Baltic Sea. However, Germany halted the project in the wake of the Russian offensive in Ukraine. Moscow has also stopped supplies to Europe via Nord Stream 1 pipeline amid sanctions. The U.S. has announced another military aid package worth $600 million for Ukraine. However, Russia has warned the U.S. against sending longer-range missiles to Kiev. Moscow says any such move by Washington will be considered as crossing a red line and will become a direct party to the conflict. During our news review program, we'll discuss the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen. Welcome to the news review section of this program. Russia warns the United States against supplying Ukraine with long-range missiles, saying such a decision by Washington would, quote, cross a red line. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said any such move by the U.S. would make it a party to the conflict. She stressed that Moscow reserves the right to defend its territory. The U.S. has supplied Ukraine with advanced rockets fired from HIMARS launchers. Washington says Kiev has promised not to use them to strike Russian territories. In the meantime, the United States is preparing to send Ukraine another package of military assistance. The United States and its Western allies have delivered large quantities of weapons to Kiev to help it fight with Russia. Moscow has time and again accused the West and the U.S. in particular of fanning the flame of war by arming Ukraine. Well, let's dig a little deeper. I have two guests joining me in this news review. Judith Bellow, senior member of the United National Anti-War Movement from Rochester, and Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol. Thanks to the both of you for joining us. I really appreciate it. Starting with you, Judith, Russia says the U.S. will become a direct party to the Ukraine war if it provides Kiev with long-range missiles capable of hitting targets inside Russia. What's your take on this?
Well, my take on it is that the U.S. participation in this war is already very dangerous. In fact, they are already directly participating through their provision of weapons and other support to the Ukrainian government. So the real question is, how far will they go and what will the Russians do about it? I think that it's expectable that the Russians would of course oppose this kind of move. And at the same time, they understand how dangerous it is to allow this to become on the surface a direct war between the United States and Russia. Ukraine is in an interesting position because although they're the place where the war is actually happening, and they're behaving like any country in a war in some ways, for instance, by getting these long-range missiles, they want to take the war to Russia. And if you take an example, say, of the Iran-Iraq war or some other war that between two countries that have a border, of course, the one country, the attacked country, is going to want to drive their attacker back across the border and to share the damage, so to speak. At the same time, because this is a proxy war, that's really inappropriate behavior for Ukraine, and it's the reason why this is such a horrible situation for Ukraine, and it's caused by their own incompetent and corrupt leadership. So I'm not sure, this is a push-pull, and from the very beginning, the U.S. has been pushing Russia. And I personally was surprised that when Putin said, okay, we're going to go in and fight back in Ukraine, because he'd been holding himself and the country really back for such a long period of time. And now the U.S. is keeping it up. They're continuing to up the ante in what turns out to be, you know, a globally significant game of chicken where there really can't be any winners in the long run. So it's really hard to say how it will turn out, only that this is creating a more and more and more dangerous situation.
Right. So going over to Tony. Tony, thank you very much for joining us. Judith thinks that
the U.S. wants to take the war into Russia and onto Russian territory in order to prolong the war. Do you think this is why the West is ignoring intentionally the warnings of Russia for fueling the war with arms and basically prolonging the war?
Well, look, here in the West, we have intense censorship and propaganda. So years ago, we used to hear about how terrible it was that China had an internet firewall. Now we have an internet firewall. We are not allowed in England, in Britain, and in Europe, and in the United States to look at the much of the content which is being, the news which is coming out of Russia. And so we're not allowed to see the Russian point of view of these things. And so that is obviously a pre-World War propaganda, media, but psychological warfare operation going on there. But look, what are these missiles that the United States has been supplying since August into this conflict? It should be obvious that the Ukrainians may be pressing the buttons to fire these rockets. 50 miles is their range, roughly, the high Mars. But the intelligence as to where to fire them at is coming via US satellites, NATO satellites, and the NATO intelligence. So this is really a NATO war where they have mercenaries and they have the Ukrainian army sitting on the ground pressing buttons for them. And the obvious reaction from the Russians to something like the introduction of these 50-mile range, well, they're called rockets. It's called the High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, the HIMARS. But actually, they're not rockets. These warheads, they have the M30A1 warheads, six on each of these vehicles. They actually do have GPS tracking and the inertial guidance system, some of them. In fact, they are basically missiles. They're not rockets at all. So a rocket is something that doesn't have guidance. These do. And if you remember a year ago in Afghanistan, one of these was fired by the United States and it killed 20 innocent civilians. They are very dangerous pieces of equipment. And the obvious ploy from the Russian point of view is to make sure that they intensify the fighting in order to push all of these Ukrainian troops and create a buffer zone of at least 50 miles with the Russian border. Well, they've pretty much done that anyway, and so they will have to go even further.
Absolutely, very interesting to see how things will plan out. Thanks to the both of you for sharing your insights. Judith Bellow, senior member from the United National Anti-War Movement from Rochester, and Tony Gosling from Bristol. Thanks to the both of you for joining us. Thank you. And on that note, we've come to the end of our news review program.
Welcome back. Just weeks ahead of Brazil's presidential elections, an opinion poll showed the incumbent leader Jair Bolsonaro is leading or lagging behind his main rival, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. According to a survey by the Datafolha Institute, the far-right president could get 33% of the votes against 45% for Lula da Silva in the first round. The survey expects a runoff in which Lula da Silva would win by 54% of the ballots against 38% for Bolsonaro. That shows a rise in popularity for the leftist veteran politician since last week. Bolsonaro has lost much of his popularity due to his contentious management of the COVID-19 pandemic and the economy. Earlier, he said he would retire from politics if he failed to come out victorious in the vote next month. Millions of lovers of the third Shia Imam have flocked to the Iraqi city of Karbala to mourn the anniversary of the 40th day of his martyrdom. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, is venerated in the Muslim world for upholding justice. He is a universal epitome of freedom as well as resilience against oppression. Now a convoy that reflects the Palestinian cause is participating in Arba'in March. The Iranian army has hosted an international mountain climbing event. The sports event engaged participating troops in a five-day climb up to the top of Iran's Mount Damavand. Yusuf Jalali reports.
5,600 meters does not seem to be a long distance, but when it's upward, it turns into a breathtaking race against gravity. Climbers from the armies of Iran, Russia, Tanzania, India, and Armenia jointly conquered the highest peak in Iran and West Asia, Mount Damavand. The joint climb began on September 10th and wrapped up after 5 days with an award ceremony.
Damavand is very steep and covered with concrete stones and sharp corners with ice that is very impressive to climb Damavand.
For me, it was very interesting to take part in this event as a president of Climbing Federation of Russia also, because it's something new. It's not a competition as we used usually. It's a festival.
As the host, Iran had a strong presence. Out of the 70 mountaineers who reached the top of Mount Damavand, 56 were from Iran. The event comes as part of an initiative launched by the International Military Sports Council, or shortly CISM. Established in 1948, the Brussels-based entity organizes up to 20 different sports competitions for the armies of 140 member states every year, with the aim of encouraging peace through sports.
Climbing for Peace is the motto of this mountaineering event. The CISM says, aside from enhancing the physical preparedness of the participating soldiers, the ultimate goal of this event is to foster peace and friendship among the armed forces of different nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that's a wrap for this hour's World News. Stay with us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The EU silence toward the atrocities of the Zionist regime has made this bloc complicit in the Israeli regime's crimes against Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Al Jazeera English wrote, "The very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that, on Palestinian rights, Brussels won't do much. In late June this year, the European Union announced that it would resume funding for two Palestinian NGOs, including Al-Haq and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. It had suspended financial support in May 2021 after the Zionist regime authorities supplied the European Commission with a dossier that claimed that six Palestinian NGOs, including Al-Haq, were funneling EU funds to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which the Zionist regime describes as a terrorist organization. A few months later, the Israeli regime war ministry extended that terrorist designation to these NGOs too. EU authorities have found no suspicions of irregularities and/or fraud. Still, on August 18th, Israeli regime forces raided the offices of seven Palestinian nonprofits in the occupied West Bank. Be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, the raids, or the all-too-frequent military onslaughts on Gaza, the EU has done little to hold the Zionist regime accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. We'll be right back. This is not a diplomatic lapse or misstep. It's important to understand that this impunity is guaranteed in the terms and conditions of EU-Israel relations, where political and economic relations are in no way contingent on the nature of the latter's conduct towards Palestinians. As a result, the Zionist regime can willfully violate Palestinian rights without fear of significant retribution from the EU, its biggest trade partner. The EU-Israel Association Agreement was ratified by EU member states' parliaments, the European Parliament and the Knesset, and entered into force in 2000 after decades of evidence of the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian rights. Following global outrage regarding the recent Israeli regime raids on the offices of Palestinian NGOs, Brussels decided to adopt a tougher tone. Joseph Borrell, the EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, said, "These actions are not acceptable." Yet even now, the EU's concern appears limited to words. In reality, the legal and political basis for EU-Israel relations does not allow for any recognition of Israel's role as a colonial occupier. The bloc of 27 nations has shown no desire to change that. The result? The EU is not an honest or effectual stakeholder in the struggle for Palestinian sovereignty and independence. On the contrary, its approach allows the Israeli regime to operate with complete impunity, human rights be damned. Electronic Intifada wrote that the European Union adores the Israeli regime should come as no surprise to anyone. But in the case anyone had doubts, the bloc's regional peace process envoy, Seven Koopmans, decided to make that clear in an op-ed for Haaretz this week. Almost every sentence oozes with praise and deference for the apartheid regime. Koopmans, of course, never uses the A word. As Israel's neighbor, historic friend, and largest trading partner, enjoying excellent cooperation in technology, education, and much more, we care, Koopmans says, adding, "Europeans understand Israel's security concerns. The EU strongly supports Israel's right to fight terrorism within full respect of its international human rights obligations," he said. That's a license for the fabricated regime of Israel to freely kill Palestinians, since the EU has never held the Israeli regime to any international human rights obligations. Meanwhile, Koopmans never acknowledges the right of Palestinians to resist occupation and colonization. Electronic Intifada said, Koopmans does acknowledge that Palestinians suffer, but he equates them with their oppressors and no hold the Israeli regime accountable for inflicting this suffering. It's apparently not the Zionist regime that keeps millions of Palestinians under occupation and without rights, but some mystical situation. Koopmans appears to be skirting around how much of the world, the Western world, being the latecomers, understand that Israel is a settler colonial regime that perpetrates the crime against humanity of apartheid. So what's the solution that Koopmans comes up with? Is it to demand the implementation of the countless UN resolutions that hold Israel in violent contempt of international law? Is it to impose costs on Israel for refusing to do so? Is it to defend and uphold the rights of all Palestinians, especially refugees, whom Israel bars from returning home solely because they are not Jews? In fact, Koopmans doesn't mention international law at all. Instead, he urges that those who are of goodwill need to work together to envisage a comprehensive peace, including Israelis, Palestinians, and in fact, the entire region. What he comes up with is the jargon of a management consultant or perhaps a self-help guru saying, "Indeed, let us reverse engineer the solution. Rather than draw another roadmap, let's together start drafting the destination, even when essential parts of it can only be identified by Israelis and Palestinians, and probably only once they themselves have almost arrived," he claimed. The EU has, along with its masters in Washington, imposed unprecedented sanctions aimed, so far unsuccessfully, at crushing Russia's economy. And they are funneling fighters and billions of dollars of weapons to help Ukrainians fight. The double standard is very obvious even to those who work inside the halls of Brussels. Last month, Joseph Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief and Koopman's boss, admitted as much in an interview with El Pais, saying, "Resolving the situation of the people trapped in that open-air prison, that is Gaza, is not in the hands of the EU. It is a scandalous situation, a shame, but it is not in our hands to solve it." Borrell responded, simultaneously acknowledging the horror the EU's Israeli friends subject Palestinians to, while at the same time absolving Europe of responsibility. As if a mere bystander, Borrell wrings his hands that the international community should find a solution for the crowded people without electricity, almost without drinking water. "We are often criticized for having double standards," Borrell adds. "But international politics is largely the administration of double standards. We do not face all problems with the same criteria," he said. If that's not bad enough, here is the punchline from this joke of a diplomat. "There is no solution to the conflict in the Middle East without a very strong commitment on the part of the United States." Borrell is admitting that the EU can only follow orders from Washington and has no or is not willing to assert any freedom of action.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us contemplate on a statement by the Holy Prophet's 8th infallible heir, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Raza, peace be upon him, who cautioned against drifting away from God's mercy. "The friend of any individual is his mind, and his enemy is his ignorance."
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, features of a good speech. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the features of a good speech in the Islamic lifestyle. We see that the Islam has given importance to the speaking and to the speech, and it says that you must speak in a good way, in a good manner. And the things even when you say should be the truth. And therefore, there are some features of that. The first feature of a good speech is that the person who says things, he thinks about them before he speaks. So it says like, you know, we say that think before you speak. So this is the first importance, this is the first feature of a good speech, that behind a good speech, every good speech, there is a thinking process. There is a people, like the people, when they want to say something, they first think about it, whether to say it or not. And after that, when they obviously judge the things or the environment, and then they say the things. And they use the words which are effective. So this is the result of thinking. We have narrations like, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that, فَكِّرْ ثُمَّ تَكَلَّمْ تَسْلَمْ مِنَ الذَّلَلْ, that you need to think before, first think, and then you should say something, you should speak. And it saves you from you know, having a bad speech or from having a bad effect. So it keeps you safe from the hardship. On the other hand, we have another hadith where it is said like لِسَانُ الْعَاقِلِ وَرَاءَ قَلْبِهِ, the tongue of an intellectual is behind his heart. He thinks first and then he speaks. وَقَلْبُ الْأَحْمَقِ وَرَاءَ لِسَانِهِ, and the heart of a dumb person is behind his tongue. He says things and after that he thinks that what I have said. So we should be careful when we say something, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the features of a good speech in the Islamic lifestyle. We said the first feature is that we think before we speak. The second feature in the Islam is that the speech should be in accordance with the Islamic ethics, means that a person who performs the wajibat or the things that are obligatory and he stops himself from performing the forbidden things, the haram or muharramat, such a person, when he speaks something, obviously his speech has an effect on the others. He will have whenever he talks, people listen to him. And obviously, this is very important that we become the true servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And after that, whenever we say something, it will have effects on the hearts of the people, because the hearts of the people is in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He brings the attraction of our speech in their heart, and people start loving what we say. So these are in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The third feature is that the person, whenever he speaks, he must be a truthful person. The only wordings are not important. The action is also important, that a person in his actions is a truthful person. So whenever people sees him, whenever people wants to talk about him, they remember him as a truthful person. We know that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam was known as the Amin, the trustworthy, and the Sadiq, which is truthful. And therefore people have said, like, if Muhammad says, like, there is a caravan behind this mountain, even if there is no one there, we will believe in him. Why? Because he's a truthful and trustworthy. And this is very important, that the features, one of the features is that a person practically shows that he's not a liar. He is a truthful person. He's a trustworthy person. And therefore, it will have effects on the hearts of the people, on the listeners, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Have you ever heard of fighting nature with nature? Well, that's what the San Francisco metro system in the US did to stop pigeons from overrunning the place. The station has hired a hawk as the new guard to patrol the area. Pac-Man is a 5-year-old Harris's hawk who has taken up the perch at the station. In terms of experience, he is pretty new, as he finished training only 9 months ago. The station recently renovated its building, installing netting and spikes to prevent pigeons from nesting. But these birds still seem to find their way to hang around. So with the Falconer Force, Ricky Ortiz and his hawk were hired this summer to keep the pigeons at bay.
So a typical day is we get here and we make our round. We start off down in the bottom inside the facility, making sure there's no pigeons hanging out in there. And then we work our way up here to the platforms and just check the ledges and the roof and make sure that they're not trying to sneak in on us, and keep them out. And he does a pretty good job of that.
The team patrols 3 days a week, and Pac-Man is allowed to swoop in and scare any pigeons sitting around. The Falconer says less than half of the pigeons left after the first week of Pac-Man flying and establishing the territory. Commuters and station managers say they also noticed the difference. The Falconer says he usually keeps his feathery friend happy on the job by giving him snacks throughout the day. This also encourages the hawk not to feast on the pigeons and local rodents.
Chinese astronauts are celebrating their first ever mid-autumn festival in outer space while sharing their otherworldly experience with people on Earth. The crew had a close-up view of the moon from China's Tiangong space station and their third month in space. On the occasion, the ground crew organized a series of celebrations, including a family reunion for the astronauts. The ground crew also prepared elaborate food packages that had been prepared before the launch of the spacecraft. Typically, the traditional festival is kicked off by the first viewing of the full moon and the 15th day of the eighth month of the lunar calendar. Despite being able to see the moon rise and set 16 times a day, the astronauts say the moon is special on this occasion. Most of the time, you have to visit an exhibition to see art. But what if art comes to see you instead? Well, a group of artists in Mali have created a floating art venue that will travel up and down the River Niger. It's called the Pirogue du Zem, which is a floating vessel. It's designed to host plays, exhibitions, dance shows, and so much more. The idea is to make art a movable feast that is no longer restricted to fixed venues in cities and accessible to all people. The project was created by a local artist and architect who had a vision to bring art to the masses. The vessel is 20 meters long and 6 meters wide, built with storage and enough space for exhibition. Government officials say the floating venue will showcase Mali's talents and creativity while attracting tourists.
Colombia is known for its tourist attractions and is full of breathtaking natural sights such as beaches, mountains, deserts, and forests. The South American nation is also one of the few places that give tourists the chance to have an encounter with whales. Every year, from July to October, domestic and foreign tourists flock to Colombia's Pacific coast to catch a glimpse of humpback whales. The large animals reach the coast after traveling thousands of kilometers from Antarctica and southern Chile. But for visitors, there are strict rules to help preserve the area and the whales. Tourists are now being welcomed for whale watching after a two-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. This is also the time when humpback whales start their reproductive process. Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodile seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations. A wide range of cutting-edge digital technology is grabbing the limelight at the 2022 China International Fair for Trade in Services, which is underway in Beijing. The exhibition is featuring a wide range of products, including artificial intelligence, virtual reality, metaverse, and 5G. Visitors can be seen taking virtual reality driving lessons and enjoying scenarios, including different road and weather conditions, wearing VR kits. It's the leading and largest comprehensive fair for trade and services in China. This year, an increasing number of traditional service companies are speeding up their transformations, resorting to smart technologies. The event has set up 9 thematic exhibitions, including cultural and tourism services, education and sports services, hygiene and health services, engineering, consulting, and environmental services. Foam is fun to play with, particularly for kids, but when it's mixed with art, it also becomes a grown-up matter. And that's what a German artist has done, creating a sea of rainbow-colored foam as an interactive art piece and allowing the audience to enjoy themselves and become part of the art. Colors mixed by Stephanie Luning were turned into rainbow-hued foam cascading down the stairs. The performance was called Island of Foam, version 18. Excited children jumped in as soon as the bubbly sea reached the base of the stairs, delighted to be playing in the rainbow playground. The art piece is made up of largely of water and a food coloring. The artist says she loves working in public spaces and reaching a broad audience of all ages.
Because I like to be surprised by the result myself, and I like to work with this that you never know how it's going to turn out. You have the wind, the weather conditions, the locations, the audience. You never know how the people are going to respond and how the artwork turns out. And that's really what I like a lot, and also how to reach a broad audience.
However, Stephanie says there's tons of work behind all the fun, and cleaning up the mess can be hard. Interactive art is a form of art that achieves its purpose by involving the audience. The immersive art piece is part of the Greenwich and Docklands International Festival, an annual festival of performing arts and outdoor theatre.
An Iranian movie wins the grand prize for the best film in this year's Moscow International Film Festival. In its international debut, No Prior Appointment won the Best Film and the Best Actress awards. The movie is a product of Farabi Cinema Foundation and directed by Behruz Shoaibi in Iran in 2021. It is the story of a girl named Yasaman who returns to Iran from Germany after her father's death. A short stay in her father's hometown and meeting those who know him leads her to a new understanding of humans and the concept of death. The 44th edition of the Moscow International Film Festival was held this year from September 4 to 11.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Last Sunday marked the anniversary of 9/11, which paved the way for the U.S. to invade and plunder West Asia and North Africa region under the excuse of countering terrorism. The U.S., which is a terrorist regime itself, named this exploitation as the Global War on Terror, which had nothing to do with countering terrorism. Rather, it was a tactic for draining the resources of countries under its occupation. And the worst thing is that all those who committed these crimes were never held accountable. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the first part. Global Times wrote, "Over the past 21 years, the U.S., under the banner of counterterrorism, has waged wars overseas and caused tremendous suffering to the people of other countries. However, the U.S. not only failed to export its democratic system to the West Asian countries or eradicate terrorism, but at home, they have been faced with rising extremism in political and social spheres. This is iconic, given the U.S. tendency of wantonly engaging in military aggression and pursuing hegemony. The 9/11 attacks opened the curtain of the U.S. so-called global counterterrorism war. In the name of making itself safer, Washington scorched the land of other countries, like Iraq and Afghanistan. Through fighting terrorism overseas, the U.S. government also forcefully promoted U.S.-style democracy, only causing greater turmoil and human rights crisis in those countries. On the other hand, wherever the U.S. military goes, it seeks opportunities to gain material benefits like controlling the local resources. The U.S. has recently stepped up efforts to steal oil from Syria. And over the years, Washington has overthrown several governments in the region that resisted its hegemony. Global Times wrote, the U.S. war on terror has been a complete failure. It has failed to make the American people feel safer. Domestically, a report released in 2021 revealed that 20 years of post-9/11 wars had cost the U.S. an estimated $8 trillion. Instead of spending the sum on improving infrastructure and people's livelihood, addressing domestic issues and achieving social solidarity, such large amounts of money has been used to destabilize the world. This has impaired many Americans' confidence toward their country, and it contributed to the social division and political polarization of recent years in the U.S. The U.S. theft of Syria's oil serves as another example of how the U.S. resorts to whatever means to benefit itself in operations in the West Asia North Africa region. In fact, plundering the energy of other countries is U.S. real purpose. Syria's oil theft by the U.S. plainly exposed the real purpose of U.S. foreign military intervention for the sake of economic profit. The U.S. presents itself as a kind of world police, is the source of a large part of the world's turmoil and suffering. Because of the involvement of the U.S. in various parts of the world, humanitarian disasters have occurred in different regions and many refugees are still wandering to find a home. It can be concluded that the U.S. decision-making elites are not interested in the well-being of either the American people nor the people of other countries, and they are certainly not interested in promoting genuine democracy to eradicate the root of terrorism. What they really care about is plundering resources around the world in whatever name they choose, be it democracy, freedom, or fighting terrorism. RT in an